I'm Dorothy Wickenden. On today's Politics and More podcast, The New Yorker's Sarah Stillman visits Forced From Home, an interactive exhibit created by Doctors Without Borders, which attempts to recreate the experience of refugees fleeing their home countries.
I'm David Remnick, and I'm here with one of the great reporters around today, Sarah Stillman. And I hope you don't mind if I brag a little bit. She just won a MacArthur Fellowship, better known as the Genius Award. Sarah, you've written for the magazine about issues facing refugees, and you've covered the huge number of people that have been fleeing gang violence and chaos in Central America. But recently you spent an afternoon at a pretend refugee camp. What was that about?
So Doctors Without Borders decided to put on this exhibit, and it's called Forced From Home. And it's currently traveling the country from the East Coast to the West Coast. And it wasn't so much a fake refugee camp as a sort of interactive exhibit that actually tries to simulate in these different stages the various complex steps and choices of people who have actually been forced to flee their homes.
And how does it compare to a real refugee camp? Is it possible to even come close to the sense of packed-inness and desperation that you so often find in refugee camps in the Middle East or wherever you might go?
I mean, to be honest, I was totally skeptical at first. It seemed like, does the financial district really need a chance for people to come and think they've morally absolved themselves by walking around this place? But it turned out to be a kind of step-by-step look into everything from the actual boat journey, like you get inside one of the inflatable rafts, to, you know, what it looks like when Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, sets up these emergency clinics.
And were tourists going in and out of this?
There were all kinds of people. So there were school groups that included populations of kids who were themselves immigrants and in some cases refugees. But then you also saw random stragglers pulled in off the streets. And then perhaps most interesting to me was actually the people who led you through it, which were actual MSF staff members who were fresh from the field, whether dealing with Syrian refugees or, in my case, I went through it with a woman named Dr. Africa Stewart. She's an OBGYN from Georgia. She's worked with MSF in South Sudan, in Nigeria. And so you were getting these people who were kind of radiating a sense of just emerging from the fire of these crises.
I'm thinking, maybe would it make sense to go through the space?
And yeah. Let me assign your country.
Okay, great. So over here we get our country tags.
So one of the first things we did at the exhibit was to pick up a card that assigned you the country from which you're supposedly fleeing.
So Honduras, South Sudan, Syria, Afghanistan, and Burundi. And some of them are asylum seekers. Some are internally displaced persons, IDPs.
So I chose Honduras. Africa picked South Sudan. There was also a board with cellophane little placards. And each one of them had a picture of an item that you might take with you on it.
So everyone chooses five items.
So basically you can choose like what they've got, like a cell phone, water, sewing machine, passport, bottles, keys, wheelchair, guitar.
Some of these items seemed strange to me. Like, why would you bring your keys, for instance? These people are fleeing their homes. They're not, say, going out for groceries.
But it's a sentimental token. People feel like if you lock your door and take your keys, they feel like at one point this will be over and I'm going to go home. And the idea that they just want to come here and have their babies is a lie.
So I went with what I figured was a really practical choice. I chose a passport, water, I chose money and shoes, and then I chose a cell phone because a lot of the Syrian refugees I've spoken to recently have told me that the cell phone was like the most vital item, both in terms of figuring out where they were going. Literally, I've talked to people who spent time Googling, you know, how to not drown while crossing in the Mediterranean in one of these rinky-dink boats. They use WhatsApp to communicate with their smugglers, to communicate with their family members back home in Syria. So that was my thinking behind that choice.
What was the most interesting question that a kid has asked you moving through the exhibit?
The smaller ones are always curious if they should bring their pets. Because they are younger, we are hesitant to tell them that someone's going to eat your pet.
You can't bring so Dr. Stewart is an obstetrician and a gynecologist with a practice in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia. And she's also a mom of three kids. Back in 2011, she and her husband had talked about her going to work with Doctors Without Borders or with MSF, but it didn't feel real until she got a call.
I text him, MSF called, can I go to Sudan? And he texts back, autocorrect is crazy. What'd you say? And I go, no, I want to go to Sudan. It was a little bit of, if I don't go, I know what'll happen.
What'll happen?
People bleed to death. People, there's no one else who knows how to do what I do. So people walk for miles and just bleed to death, and their babies die. And in this context, when mom is unwell, her other small children are uncared for. And it just sort of changes, it can change a whole village that way. And so I figured out how to make it work. I can cook a cauldron of spaghetti sauce and turn it into four or five different things in the freezer with the label. And
is that what you do before you go off? You like prepare the meals for your time away?
Oh my goodness. It helps, partly because it helps my husband feel like, okay, that's handled, you know, like that part of it is done. And for the kids, I mean, the way your mom cooks, it's special. So he would do the best he could, but on the weekends, mommy's food. And you only have to do that four times, and then mommy will be home. And it helps.
So we got to the next stage of the exhibit. I mean, they'd placed a small kind of inflatable boat of the sort that smugglers actually use to take people across. And I think it's meant to seat around 8 people, but they're often finding, you know, 20, 25 people in these boats. And so they essentially crammed the whole tour group just the way that the refugees would be crammed in like sardines in this little boat.
We started, MSF started doing rescues in the water. And we had this whole debate of, are we making the problem worse? Because once the smugglers find out that we're going to come save them, then are they going to take more people out? And we went back and forth for a couple of days, and we decided ultimately that part of our mission is neutrality. If you need us, it doesn't matter how you got into that situation. So in the lifeboat, so we started doing rescues, and the first part of that is getting real life jackets. And we're picking people out of the water that are wearing the equivalent of props. And they were sold them. Right. They're not seaworthy. Or they're not meant for salt water.
But people are selling those. They're manufacturing basically these fake, crappy life jackets that don't even work. Mm-hmm. That's like such a cynical, that I can't even imagine who would think of that idea. But I guess there's a lot of money to be made in this crisis.
Sure.
And can you tell, like, if we look at those two jackets in the boat right there, like, can we tell which one is real and which one's fake?
Yes. I can assure you, if you are given the choice between the two, you'll pick the real one every time. But when there aren't any, you can't tell, you know?
Yeah. So then we got to the point in the exhibit where we had to give up another one of our items. I reluctantly chose to give up my cell phone and to hold on to the water because it felt like that was a really requisite object, and a cell phone seemed like a really frivolous one. Then, of course, we turned the corner, and Dr. Stewart points out that, you know, we're arriving in the MSF area, and in fact, they did provide the bare essentials, including water, so probably not the best choice.
You don't. As long as you need us, everything that you need is free.
I see. I was about to go into a place with water. Yeah, I guess you make some bad calls. I think that was a bad call. I screwed myself.
And that people always saying, like, oh, can I get that back? No. Because
I'll
that's
totally
part of the
take my cell phone back if you'll give it to me. No.
That's part of the experience, though, is choosing incorrectly and finding out later that you needed that thing or you did, or this is useless.
Yeah, it's interesting to think that in this current refugee climate that one of the most valuable things you could possibly have is a cell phone. And so later she took me to this part of the exhibit where they displayed these really innovative, creative ways that refugees had come up with in the camps to charge the phones, just impromptu self-made chargers. So at that point, we transitioned to the tents, which are, you know, the longer-term living stations, the things you've heard about in the news.
Mostly to sort of illustrate the idea that people are fleeing for months and months. If you don't drown, you aren't kidnapped, you don't get shot along the way, this is it.
I mean, it's a real shithole, to be honest. I mean, it looks like a bunch of plastic tarps draped over and... And really looks like a lot of what we would conceptualize as trash. I mean, there's a little doll made out of trash and garbage bags and a little toy made out of a milk carton with some wheels attached. But otherwise, it's just these little tents and flip-flops and the flimsiness that almost is a physical representation of these people's situations in terms of precarious. Like, it looks like the wind could blow away this whole place.
And this is long-term housing. This is what they fled to. So if you can appreciate that this is good news to a lot of families, then it shines a light on what they left. The seriousness of it, the lack of safety, warmth,
The exhibit ends there, but it definitely left me thinking, partly just about how I'd walked into it feeling pretty skeptical. I just have big questions about the nature of these exercises where, even as we try to build empathy for those going through the refugee crisis, how often are we doing that in ways that are really just self-congratulatory chances to momentarily pause from our days, quickly imagine what it's like to be someone in one of these, in these dire straits, and then to just jump back into our lives and pat ourselves on the back for having done so, but without any real stakes on the line, without really any action being taken. And this left me thinking, actually, the value in the exhibit lay elsewhere, and I think it lay in two places. And the first was really just getting outside the binaries that so much of the reporting on the refugee crisis play into, and I think those fall into either the category of tales of refugees who were really exceptional and wildly resilient and really, really special in their courage and bravery, or the tales of the kind of faceless masses. But this exhibit was really about the smaller daily choices that millions of people are making again and again and again. And it also made me think about, well, what is Dr. Stewart getting out of all of this? And it became pretty quickly clear that all of the doctors there were really having one of the first chances they'd had to talk with each other about the really intense environments in which they're operating in all these far-flung parts of the world, then sharing that with the rest of us, that there is an element of, you know, education that's an equally important part of the job.
I can get lost in the operating room. I can just be doing sexual violence repair after repair after repair, or doing fistula repair after repair after repair, because that's the thing that I can do. Most of what I use practically, I learned from my colleagues. Like, the first thing I learned is, you don't cry in front of the staff. It is better to be respected than loved. Don't cry in front of the staff. I mean, I have some secrets that I'll never speak to another soul, because it's just too heavy. But every now and again, I can call Denmark and talk to Anya, and she knows why I called. And we don't even have to talk about it. We can just say, it could have been worse. We did the right thing. I just hate how it turned out. So we get the training. We get it, but we get it on the fly. And sometimes it's some Australian going, "Aye, buck up." Okay. Sometimes that's all I needed. Just, okay, I'm back on it. Wash your hands. Do it again. Just don't give up. And I always say I'm not going back to the field, and I do. Always. I probably have it in my chat with my husband. I'm never coming back. Never. It's too much. I'm too old for this crap. And he's like, uh-huh. We'll talk about it when you get home. Because he's right.
That was Sarah Stillman.